Hi, and welcome to another episode of CineNation. My name is Brandon Sparks.
And I am Ben Gertz.
I'm currently in Anaheim, California, and Ben is in beautiful Portland.
The lovely Portland, Oregon. Come on, Brandon, move to Portland.
I'm not moving to Portland. I'll visit Portland.
Well, you can retire here. That's where most people do. Most young people.
Most young people who are filthy rich retire to Portland. Is that what it is?
Yes, I live in a McMansion. Anyway, let's move.
Okay, moving on. So, today we're going to discuss, it's kind of something that's been going through some people that I've talked to, like in my personal life outside the show, with their film and the theory, or the auteur theory. Basically saying that the director is the author of the film. And
yeah, the primary author. Really.
The primary author of the film. Yeah. Not the writer, not the producer, but it's the director. And it kind of came over from Europe, correct? Like the whole auteur theory.
The history of it's... I think it was... because for a while I considered getting a master's in film, and so I was reading up on like what would I be learning if I did a master's, and so much of it is depending on the school, obviously, but so much of it is about digging into like, you know, historic films and film criticism, and you know, basically intellectualizing a lot of the process. And man, there is just nothing more uninteresting about film than film criticism. I know that's a very childish thing to say, and it depends on the criticism, and there are great critics, but I think the auteur theory has been perpetuated and brought forward into the consciousness like of a lot of people just purely through critics, through film criticism. Not because filmmakers are necessarily going around saying like I am an auteur. It's because others are labeling them as such, and
I
especially
agree.
This revision of film history, you know, to go back and say like, oh, look at how all these films connect together, because the common element is the director, you know.
Yeah,
it's a very simplistic lens to look back through and see correlation and like causation that may or may not be there.
Yeah, and I agree that most of the time it's that title is given by critics, but the big thing, and even filmmakers who think of their heroes in film, but it's kind of, there's very, like, you can argue certain people as auteurs, but they're giving it to people that really, like, for example, Alfred Hitchcock, people would argue is one of the greatest auteurs that was in film. But the thing with Hitchcock was, Hitchcock directed, Hitchcock never really wrote his scripts, but he worked heavily with the writer of the script, like on the script, but he never wrote it. He was never the DP. I don't know if I think he produced, but he wasn't the main guy. And then the biggest one, like you can argue certain, like Orson Welles, you could easily argue as one of the ones that was an auteur, because he wrote, directed, and produced and acted in all of his own stuff pretty much. And it's more usually the people who are on the not the art house, but kind of the art house non-studio films. And
yeah, but here's the thing that's disappointing and I think simplistic about it.
Yeah,
and it's two different things. The disappointing thing is like so much of, and we'll include a link to this great article you sent me from AV Club with Alex Garland, and he's talking about, like, you know, he was a writer, a book, you know, an author of books.
A novelist.
A novelist. Thank you. Ding, ding, ding. And, you know, so he's like, I sat alone in a room and occasionally would talk to an editor, and then I wrote books, you know? And the thing that drew him to cinema and to film is the collaborative nature. And I think that's the same for me, as like the thing that has, you know, always kind of like drawn me towards it has been like a chance to work with great people and to not necessarily like to me, you know, and just in the few things that a few projects I have worked on, consistently the thing that like will just like light, you know, they'll just like all the neurons fire off in my head of like, oh man, this is perfect, is not when I come up with a great idea. I mean, some of those are nice. It's like, oh good, I worked hard and I found this solution. It's when someone else brings something to the table, that I never saw coming, and it just, it just sideswipes you, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is the whole reason we were doing this, is because of this underlying thing I didn't see, or this, you know, this outside perspective. So the collaborative nature is just so inherent to the art form. It's just so obviously inherent to the art form. And it's really easy to rebut a lot of these examples that get thrown around. I mean, Wes Anderson, right, an auteur where you consistently can see his hand at work. I mean, he works with the same crew. Like, one of the hallmarks of his career is that he has worked with the same group of people from the beginning. I mean, people talk about that. And same with the Coen brothers, auteurs, right? They work with, like, a lot of the same people. They've got deacons whenever he's available. And, you know, famously, like, they have, like, a very relaxed set. And they have, like, very, you know, they keep it to, like, 8 hour, you know, 8 to 10 hour production days. Like, they're trying to make other people happy because it's not all about them. They're not running around like, we are our tours and welcome to our our vision. And I think, you know, it's just, I hope that we can, I'm not sure what we or who anyone can present that's gonna like shift the narrative, but it's just like, please can it go away? Because it, to me, it is like the, it's the most, you know, being in technology now and seeing some of the same sort of narratives crop up in like startups, right? A lot of journalism, you know, quote unquote, about startups and startup history is typically the same sort of thing of like auteur theory related to founders and this idea that like founders are an essential element, and there is actual, like, you know, there's actual data that people have started to put out about different types of founders and founder teams and the significance of where the founders went to school and all these different things, right? But I don't know, like, it there's a lot of similarities, and to me it's like, you know, it makes sense maybe at a startup level, I suppose, but for film, it's just so, it's so inherently collaborative. And I think everyone who's ever worked on a production just knows that it's not their one decision that like brought beauty onto the screen. You know, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and we're like at USC, where I go to film school, it's, they really preach a collaborative environment. Like, I had a professor this past semester who was always like, never say my film, it's always our film, because you did not shoot it, you did not produce it, you did not do everything of all the jobs on the set. There, I do not want to see like a Brandon Sparks film in the credits, because it's not a Brandon Sparks film. It's y'all, it's the group's film. So they really preached, and he was a professor who would like stop you if you said my film or her film. It's like, no, no, it's y'all's film.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of young filmmakers, I think personally, that I notice don't really get, or it's not like a, they don't understand it, because I have people who are like, "Well, this is my film. I want to do it this way. Like, this is my film. This is no one else's film." And I'm like, "Well, did you shoot it? No. Okay. Did you produce it? No. Did you write it? No. So how is it just your film and no one else's film?"
Yeah, and you know, it's almost like it's something that has been instilled in people from an early age. I don't know where it seeps in. I think it comes from the way that films are promoted typically. Yeah. And I think it also comes from the way that films are written about at a popular level. Not necessarily, well, I mean, even at a critical level though. I think that a lot of the people who you know, it's a convenient way to package and promote films. You know, the Directors Guild has the deals of like how names are presented on posters, how they're, you know, and then a lot of times you'll see it in trailers. Like, you're not going to see, you know, edited by, you know, any particular editor, right? That's not something people are promoting. And it is easier to promote actors and directors. But I don't know. There's just, there's so many examples that I feel like just are accumulating that. Yes, it's important. Everyone should have a unique perspective at every level of the film. And a director can have a much more substantial sway over how mm-hmm. a film is ultimately like delivered, because they tend to be at the final check mark of what how things are going to be. But I don't know, it's just so boring to me. I mean, just boring at every level, to be like, you know. And this is a shameless crossover into the thing to really talk about, but True Detective. I'm dropping True Detective early because I feel like this is something to rant about. You're already bored with. You're bored. But here's the thing, though. All the articles written about how Nick Pizzolatto was a genius.
Yes.
That is just, in retrospect now, it you look like a fool if you wrote that article. Because, I mean, and it's no offense to them. Like, we all thought that he was a genius. And that in itself is problematic, right? To inscribe that on a person so quickly and so, you know, with one show. But,
let me preface this just so, yeah, like, preface. So we go, is that at this, I think at this day and age, we see film as the director's medium and we see television as the writer's medium, because that's kind of how it's always been, the writer's in control. And now it's truer than any other era, probably, that the writer is more in control. And the thing now is that television and film is very, the lines are very blurred compared to what they used to be, like in the 90s and before. They're very blurred of like what's film, what's television. So now we're going into the auteur theory for television, but as a writer-producer standpoint.
Right, so, and some of that's from the production, like, economics in a way of, like, the showrunner has typically been the head writer and the creator and not a director. And the directors have been guns for hire in television.
And it kind of changed with Sopranos, and then even more so with Breaking Bad. Because Breaking Bad had someone like Vince Gilligan who was, he was the guy at the helm. But Gilligan didn't direct every episode. I don't think Gilligan wrote every episode. He might have wrote every episode, but he was heavily involved in the writing of every episode. But I don't know if he wrote every episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have been a writer's room, right? I mean, so collaborative.
That's what I'm leading to, is that with True Detective, reason why season one was so, what I think was good, was because it was a film. It was an 8-hour long film. It was one writer, and it was one director, and it was, even though they might have, from the rumors, they might have bickered back and forth about certain things, it was still a unified vision at the very end of it. Mm-hmm. And now, it's not like that. There isn't that, with True Detective Season 2, there wasn't that second person who was fighting for their vision over the other person's vision. Season 2 was pretty much, like I said earlier, was that it became a regular TV show. It wasn't the film cinematic TV show that we saw the year before, where you could tell, like, it was one complete story by basically the same two people. And now it's become like, oh, a regular TV show. It's a different director, like, every episode or every two episodes. And yes, there is just that one writer who's also the producer of it, and he's the one that's doing it all. So it's basically become a regular TV show. And because of that, this is what I call this, is that basically Pizzolatto got the Lucas syndrome, George Lucas syndrome.
Yeah.
Basically meaning after a big success, you get to a point where no one will tell you no.
Yeah.
Or no one will say, that maybe rethink that. And the way it looks, that's what happened with season 2 of True Detective. That there was no one really telling Pizzolatto, you know what, like, maybe you shouldn't do this. Because
who else had articles written about him saying that they're a creative god? You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Yeah, that Vanity Fair article.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That Vanity Fair article, kind of, I was like, really? This guy really comes off, like, terrible right now. But the thing about it is... Like I said, it's a regular TV show, and the biggest, because we, I know you really want to talk about this, is comparing it to season one. The big thing to me was that season two got way too complex, and it was supposed to be more about the characters and less about the plot, I felt like, but then it got completely about plot, Because, like, that was the whole thing, was that episode one had no plot whatsoever. None. It was just getting to know the characters. And then episode two is when the plot starts. But then by the end of the season, I'm like, I don't know who's who right now. Like, I don't know who these, some of these characters are they're mentioning. I don't know what their importance is. They really had no effect. And by the end of it, the whole kind of, I'm not really spoiling this, but by the end of it, the whole
Brandon,
thing
here's
of
the thing though, we have to spoil it. Okay, like here's the, because of this one key reason, it is so bad. I want to keep people from it. I do. I want to do this service. Please let me spoil this so that we can have like a thorough, like, just thrashing of this thing. Can we do that?
Okay. So, but start off with, because you want to do this, give an overview of season one and an overview of season two.
Well, I've been asking friends who've seen both. I've just had basic, and I did this to, you know, I'm kind of a jerk sometimes, I guess. I used to ask my siblings, like, while they were watching Lost, I would say, like, what's going on? And just knowing, you know, that it would spark this craziness, and they'd look at me and they'd be like, you know, they couldn't even, they're like, I can't even begin to explain it, you know, it's Lost, it's amazing. And I was like, okay, as soon as you can explain it at some level to me, I'm interested. Not that I'm just, like, I'm not trying to be, like, the annoying, like, you know, I'm not just purely interested in facts. I'm fine if it's, like I'm watching Sense8 on Netflix. I can't really explain that show to you. But, like, I know, like, I can't, but at the same time, I kind of can. You know, like, at the end of episode one, I understand that there's 8 people who are all tied together in some weird way that I don't really understand, but their consciousness are all somehow like interconnected or cross-connected with other people, and that's the framing device that allows us to jump all around the world to different people, right? That's a pretty, that's like a 30-second, what is the show?
That's pretty much that's pretty much Cloud Atlas too, the movie they did before.
Right, which I haven't seen, but, which, I mean, maybe we should have a sound effect for every time I say, like,
I liked it.
I haven't seen.
I want to see it.
No, but I've been asking people, explain to me what is in season two of True Detective. Like, explain it to me. You know, just tell me the summary of the season. And you just can't. I mean, I haven't heard one that isn't a whole bunch of stutters and just,
well,
there's these cops and the transportation
I'm going to try.
Hit me.
Season two is about 3 cops from 3 different areas of law enforcement, or 3 different, like, divisions, and they come together to solve a murder of a transportation office, like a public official who has had dealings with a former mafia guy or a former mob guy or a former criminal in Vince Vaughn. And basically their lives are supposed to be intertwined to the murder of that one guy. That's what's supposed to be.
Right. I mean, well, but see, supposed to be, like, that's
of that,
what
of that
we're,
one crime. Or with that one crime.
But, like, that's the
that's the problem.
Yeah, well, in a way, kind of like the promise that we're given at the beginning.
Yes.
And this is all debatable, right? About whether it should be subverting our expectations or not.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, at its basic level, that's definitely at the end of episode one, that's what we're kind of told. And, you know, reading back through some of these quotes from Pizzolatto, he attributes all this, you know, he's like, season one, people are asking about the ending of season one, and he said something, I'll find the quote again, but it's like, you know, well, you know, the end was really the beginning of the writing process, you know, and that the line about the darkness, what the light winning over the darkness or whatever, he's like, that was one of his key lines of dialogue that drove the whole thing, and the entire journey and arc of the season is to get to that moment.
Yeah.
And I mean, okay, so take him at his word for season one. What on earth was his anchor at the end of season two that got us to where we were? Do you know what I mean? Like, what is the line of dialogue? Because that, I don't know, I texted you some of the things that they were saying.
Yeah.
You know, because it just fell to pieces in so many places. I know it's just bad form to beat this horse while it's so down, but, like, I don't know. Like, to me, Here's my interest in it and the reason to talk about it with you and annoy people listening to this. You could quit at any time because we will spoil it. But to me, it is just like, I've been thinking a lot about it because I want to understand in my own mind, like, and a lot of this is purely speculative, obviously, purely speculative. But to think through, like, what was someone trying to do? Maybe it was Pizzolatto. Maybe it was the actors or director trying to work with what they had. But what were they intending to do, as best we can tell from what we've seen? And then how would those tensions have misfired, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, is it a performance thing? Is it something else that's just mechanical in nature? You know, like things just didn't quite sync up and work.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's had my brain running is like, I just don't even understand if it had all gone perfectly, how it would have been. I know that's simplistic to say, but like, because there are scenes, for example, the scene of Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams sitting in the cabin. This is episode 7, season two. And they're sitting there sharing the bottle of booze silently with this, like, you know, Mickey Mouse, shouldn't attach his name to this, we'll get sued, but the cheap fireplace burning behind them, this kind of like Americana, you know, ironic thing or whatever. I don't know, it just, so many things felt all on the nose to me, but they're sitting there, and to me, you know, I wish we could include clips without getting sued, but like, to me, it felt like a student film. It felt like a student film, even with obviously two very competent actors.
Yes.
What was supposed to be infused with so much tension and longing and complexity just literally felt like two people staring at each other. And it was so long, just so long of them sitting there and eventually holding hands and eventually, you know, because she's like, I don't talk about what happened. And he like doesn't push her on the issue, and you know, all these things that are supposed to be these complexities that are like a great whiskey or something, right? And it just felt like whiskey. It just felt terrible. Like, well, here's
my thing, because it's on that topic, and this is kind of the problem with a lot of moments that were supposed to be big moments in the season that they didn't have any importance to it. Is that there wasn't enough build to it. Yeah. For example, they're like all of a sudden Rachel McAdams and Colin Farrell start having sexual tension, which really hasn't been present in the entire season up until that moment. Like, it hasn't really to that episode really been present at all. The same thing kind of happened with the shootout midway through the season. It just kind of came out of nowhere. It's like. And also, too, the big thing about the season was it felt like we were supposed to be following Rachel McAdams' character. That was the whole – it was leading up to Rachel McAdams' character was going to be the hero of it all. And in the end, she does nothing, in all honesty.
To just ruin it in every way and spoil it, she does survive.
Yes.
You know, and the final – this is what is so mind-boggling to me is, like, the final 3 minutes – are them in Venezuela, right?
Yeah.
And she's talking with the reporter and she's handing over all the documents. And to me, what's so weird is, you know, there was a lot of criticism of, I'll finish the thought. I don't know, like the end of season one was criticized because it was too narrow, right? Everyone wanted it to be this big ending, right? Of like, the Yellow King and the Great Carcosa and all these things. And then even when it got down to like, well, there's this weird collection of politicians and just sexual deviants, basically. They wanted at least some big person to come down with the House of Cards, I guess you'd
I'm
just gonna get sued by using all these names. and so that was at the end of season two, I mean, it ends on her turning over these documents and she's like, don't follow me. You know, I'm walking away. And they play up, they crank up Lyra Lynn, who is the best part of season two, playing another great song, right? Original music for the show. And it just ends. And the thing that struck me was like, okay, now we're getting started. Like, that's really what it felt. That's literally what it felt like to me is like, You could have. Like, seriously.
No, I don't disagree.
I mean, it felt like to me, like, okay, you could have killed off all those people. You could have shown so much of the, so much less of the just violence randomly and had a much more condensed thing. And, like, I know people are, you know, pretty much bored of all the, like, Snowden leak conspiracy things.
Yeah.
But it's just as worn out now as a LA transportation conspiracy. You know what I mean? But to me, it just felt like, okay, well, now we're getting ready to have the story about the newspaper reporter and Rachel McAdams trying to deal with leaking out all this information. And, like, like, I felt like we were getting ready to set up a House of Cards episode, basically, or a season. You know, I don't know. Like, I know that's a wandering of a random person's mind. Well, but
I'm gonna say this because I was Ben and I were kind of the exact opposite throughout the season. Was I was waiting to give it a chance. I was kind of like, it'll get there. Like it's picking up in some spots, and Ben just kind of hated it throughout the entire season.
I mean, that's a little unfair. I wanted it to be good, and my disappointment was deep.
Yeah, that was my thing at the end of the finale. I've never, in all honesty, because I don't watch as much TV as I should, and that was like one of my first times. Like,
how much TV should you watch?
Well, anyway. That was like the first time where I was watching a season throughout the entire, like, watching the entire season, and when the season finale came, I was like, wow, that was really disappointing, because I'm like, there was no build to the characters, and it felt like Pizzolatto just apparently got really upset with all the critics from last season of like the things he should have done, and by that group, it's a very small group of people who said that of like, oh well, it should have been more complex, it should have been more like surreal, more people should have died. So you're like, you know what, I'll give them all that in the last episode and it'll make no sense, but it's what they want, that's what they said they wanted. I'm just like, but you're forgetting the majority of people who loved the way you did it. Yeah, they probably thought there were some problems with the ending. They thought it was actually too simple. But everything else that you did right in that season, it felt like it was just blatantly ignored in season two.
Yeah, I think to tie it back into our tour theory a little bit, like I've been rewatching season one. This is like the third time through, which is I don't do this often, right? But watching back through a lot of these scenes, like, number one, I'm appreciating, like, Woody Harrelson's performance even more.
Yes.
Matthew McConaughey at even another level. And then just so many other performances are unbelievable. But what I think works so well with a lot of these performances is you can tell that there's a very strong, like, relationship to the camera.
Yeah,
and this is all, again, this is, you know, I'm just speculating in some ways, but watching back through, there's so many places where there's a clearly, like, very intentional camera movement that's subtle in a lot of places. There's a lot of times where, you know, we were rewatching when they go to the bunny farm, you know, out in the woods, as they call it, the bunny farm, right? And they're in the trailer talking to one of the young women that knows the woman that was murdered in season one, and the framing, it's a small thing in comparison, like, but I think one of the things that made it so great is like the framing is just off kilter in a lot of places where, and you know, you start to notice these things from film school, right? Of like they're using like you know, they're obscuring certain characters with other, like, just like half the frame is taken up with like the back of Woody Harrelson, right? Yeah. As they're cutting over to McConaughey and vice versa. There's all these things that are like, it's not a straight on, you know, just singles of each person. They have them and they cut to them, but there's a lot of internal framing and there's just really dense, just complexity. There's just inherent complexity in the way it's shot. That's so imbued into it in places that are very small and not heavy-handed. And I mean, I'm telling you, in season two, like, so many places where I'm like, why is this so boring? Why is this so disappointing? And I'm looking at it and I'm going, because this is just like every other, like, it's like the, you know, I was trying to make fun of it and it's like, it's just a very expensive CSI episode. Like, it's a really long, expensive cop drama, because there's just very little very little complexity, like we saw in the last season, where there's not as much camera movement. There's a whole lot of just encounters where they're just single, back to OTS, back to OTS. You know, like, they're just not doing a lot to bring that same urgency. And I don't know. I mean, I'd like to go further. I want to have proof somehow, but I also don't want to get sued for, like, you know.
Here's my thing, because I wanted to like the season, and there are parts of it I like, because I love the thing that kept me in it always, and what keeps me in most movies, is the actors, and that I like the actors. I know you kind of don't like some of them, but I like pretty much all of them.
And I don't like actors, like, in general, as a group of people.
No, you mean some of the people that are some of the actors in the show. Some of the actors
season
in the
two.
Show. Yeah, season two.
Colin Farrell's not my favorite person, you know, just...
But to me, he was, like, the best part of the season. Like,
yeah, I mean, they really tried to make him the best part of the season.
No, the problem is he shouldn't have been the main character. It should have been Rachel McAdams was the main character.
Well, she... I don't know. I mean, wasn't she the main character?
No.
Here's the thing that's so confusing. I know. Here's the thing that's so confusing is, like, we had so much... The thing is, the backstory we did get for a lot of these characters was so redundant. You know what I mean? Like, there was a lack of efficiency in the way that we're packaging those things up. And I know that's kind of callous, I guess. But, like, when we're learning about Rachel McAdams, she had that weird... I'm really surprised, like, with her dad, right? Her sister and her dad.
Yeah.
They're brought up, and, like, do we really even talk to her dad other than, what, 3 or 4 scenes? And they're, like, very simplistic for the most part of, like, he's combative, you know, in this, like, kind of passive-aggressive hippie way.
Like, I can't believe you became a cop, and then, like...
Yeah. And so it's like, okay. I thought for sure the moment, and this is the thing, I was like, maybe some of these things are set up to try and subvert our expectations, right? But the moment I saw him, because of some of his other performances, the guy who played her dad.
David Morse,
who's great, like, super good. And I'm like, okay, if you've cast him, like, he's in this because something crazy is going to go down. You know,
I thought the same thing.
Yeah. And it's fine. You know, you think about it with season one. Right, there's a bit towards, it's when Matthew McConaughey goes to the school, and finds the little wooden triangles or, you know, whatever the craft projects.
Yeah,
the voodoo symbols. I don't know what we're supposed to call them. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But when he finds them, it's cross cut with this whole sequence where, you know, the whole time that those two, because you feel it throughout the season, the two cops that are interviewing them are pushing and asking all these leading questions of, like, and what did you think about the way Cole was pushing the investigation, right? And, like, subtly, by the time you get to see to that sixth episode where the where he's alone, like, and finding all these clues, they're finally set up in your head of, like, maybe he was doing all this and then leading them around in a wild goose chase because it was really him, right? And we know very quickly within the next episode, it's like, no, it's not him. But it's a really nice cliffhanger to end the episode on. And that's the thing I think is so interesting in season one is, like, almost every cliffhanger, almost every kind of, almost everything we end an episode on is a red herring, right? Yes. It's like, look over here. Don't look at this hand. You know, we're doing a magic trick.
Yeah.
And I mean, where does that happen in season two? I haven't gone back and religiously studied it, but there's so much.
Well,
the
biggest one's episode two. The biggest one's episode two, when Colin Farrell shot. And we think that's the biggest one. But see, the thing is, that's the biggest one, but we never do it again, really.
We never do it again. And here's the thing, and this is a spoiler, it is. But so I watched the last episode, episode 8. It was 90 minutes. I had to watch the first 60 minutes and then like go to work. I didn't get to finish the whole episode in one sitting. And so then I watched the last 30 minutes separately, right? And really, it shocked me because it's basically two separate episodes. Episode 8, like the first 60 minutes, is all really kind of slow burn, like build up. There's a couple big moments. But the last 30 minutes are this crazy tailspin of insanity.
When all the loose ends are being tied up. And
the thing with Colin Farrell getting shot, Okay, he gets shot by the kid of the jewelry family who was murdered in 92, and he didn't kill him because, I still can't explain it. He's going to meet that other cop to kill him.
Yeah.
Right? Why? I mean, he was breaking into the house to get the evidence, and he only had to, like, he happened to be breaking in at the same time as Colin Farrell, so he had to shoot him with a blank load that he happened to buy in advance in case he ran into someone. Like, I just don't, why not kill Colin Farrell? I'm sorry. I just don't, I felt like he was set up as such a cliche, you know, of a corrupt cop and a cowboy. Like, that's the thing is, like, not only a corrupt cop, but you're going to dress him like a character from a kid's play or something. Like, I don't know, mustache. Okay. And
you're talking about when he's going to the train station. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's so many moments. There's so many moments. That's where he's kind of playing a character for himself of like, they won't notice me when I blend in, you know. And he's got the charger and all these things that are like, I just don't know. Like, where is that person in L.A.? Like, I know that L.A. is a big place. But yeah. Who is that guy? And so
there,
many
there
moments.
Are, there are people like out there like that, by the way.
No, I know. I get it. To me, it just felt the same as his partner, who was just the most cliche of cliche, yeah. Dirty cops. Like, we're the cops. You can trust us. You know, and like, what? who writes this? And who... Like, I saw that guy's IMDb page. He's a pretty normal-looking dude. Like, they cast him and turned him into, you know, the dirtiest of dirty cops. It's that's his, like, bit part he plays thing.
He's done a lot of different stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna go on this. There's a few things of my, like, for one, season one, season two are different seasons. I get that. But we're going to compare it. You're naturally going to compare it to it.
Yeah, yeah.
This one is more like David Lynch surreal style is what's trying to be. And that's a tricky thing to pull off. And I don't think it does it well. The other thing...
And it's a tricky thing to pull off. And I'll let you say your next thing. It's a tricky thing to pull off when you spend 7 episodes... there's a couple hints at surrealism with, like, after Colin Farrell does get shot, he shows up at the bar with his dad, and it's like, where am I? You know, you're in purgatory, basically.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. But hit me with your next thing.
Well, the other big thing, or there's a few things. For one, in season one, if we met a character at any point, usually that character came back around later on and was used in a different way. Like, it's used some way. If a character came in, a character became important later on. So if it's like the preacher and the revival tent thing, he comes back later on. You know, he's in one episode, like in like episode 3. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm with you. I'm thinking of other characters who don't reappear. You know, I mean, there's the women at the truck stop that McConaughey meets with. I mean, he does... The thing is, there are a lot of people who come back for more than at least one moment.
Yeah, what I mean. It's like you have the girl that Woody Harrelson talks to at the bunny farm or whatever that comes back around at the end, and they have an affair. I think is what it is. I can't remember. Or they have sex. And see that
right there is like that is infused with so much meaning because of that quip that. Matthew McConaughey hits him with his like a little bit of a down payment there.
Yeah.
You know, when he gives her the money and he's like, can you not have any decency in the moment of, you know, and of course who's right? You know, it's McConaughey. It is a down payment. It ends up being a down payment. And it's such a central part of Woody Harrelson's character is that he has this nobility that's ultimately not very noble, you know? Yeah.
And the other big thing, because I talked about this last time we talked about it, and I kind of talked to everyone about it more, especially now it's over, was of how they used the setting. Season one, it uses Louisiana fairly well, and not like city Louisiana, not like New Orleans or like Baton Rouge. It's like swamp, dirty, backwoods Louisiana, and it becomes a character. With Los Angeles, it's like we're trying so hard to make it something more than what it is. Because we're trying to do the whole transportation thing. That kind of doesn't really work because it's been done so many times before. And yeah. In all honesty, they could have found... It would have been better, and this might sound cliche, it would have been better if they actually included like more like Hollywood movie-type stuff. Because they could have kind of done some interesting stuff with it that hadn't been done before. But it's like... It's just... like it should. It didn't have to be set in Los Angeles, is what I'm saying. But it was set in Los Angeles, and... The only way we can see that Los Angeles is a character is by a whole bunch of aerial shots of freeways. And that's about it.
And that is about it. And that, you know, one of the things that people love too about season one is that opening title sequence, you know?
Yeah.
The opening title sequence that is so interesting and such a powerful way to open that first episode. I mean, my goodness, like, you know, it gives you chills basically because it's like, what in the world is going to go on? Because I've watched them now side by side, not side by side, but back to back.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first one is filled with a lot of people. You know, it's a lot of, like, detailed shots. Yeah. And you know, like, the title sequence is built by a different company, right? There's a really interesting, it's actually something we should include in the post, but there's a great breakdown from the company that did the titles talking about the meaning and significance of how they arrived at what they created. Because they even include, like, here's what we kind of thought at first, and here's another intermediate version that we made, and then here's the finals.
Yeah.
And, you know, for them, like, so much of it is, like, taking the footage that they were given and finding the meaning, you know, within that. And so there's so many, like, great shots that don't end up in the show but set up some of those moments later in the show. And season two, those titles, they're not really, you know, the shots that are in there are... you know, the main characters' faces, and that's kind of about it. And I think that's another key difference of some of the visual style of the first season and second season. There's really just not, because it's so much simpler in a bad way of season two, there's not a lot of iconic visual elements that define the style of the series.
Yeah, I mean,
season one has that little mirror, you know, that McConaughey's always going up to. There's these little things that, and his view of his room where he's waking up and the cross is over him, that gets used in the title sequence. You know, like, there's so many of those things that that work.
And yeah, that's true. And one big thing is, because there's only, usually, like, when you're watching, because you see the title sequence every week, every time you see it so much, and then when you're watching the show, you realize, oh, that's from the title sequence. You pick something out. I did that one time this season.
Yeah.
And that was the ending shot of the title sequence. And it's shown in episode 8 when Colin Farrell's, like, driving his car up the hills or whatever, and they're chasing him. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Basically, the shot when it goes, like, created by Nick Pizzolatto and written or directed or whatever. That's the same. That's the first time I'm like, oh, yeah, that's that shot. That's the only time that I ever, like, it clicked. Oh, that's the same thing. Okay. This has some meaning to it. The rest, it didn't hit me as much as it did in season one. Other thing too is that season one had less characters, but there was a plot season one, but it really didn't matter what the plot was. It was, we're getting to know the characters through the plot, and that was pretty much it. This one, it was like we didn't know how to give equal amount of time to each character. It's like, in all honesty, Colin Farrell in his role says it best in, like, episode 8 when they're asking about Taylor Kitsch's character. Did you know him? Well, no, not really.
Mm.
I'm like, that sums it up.
That's great, Brandon. That's great. Big money right there. That's tweetable.
It's like, he's like, yeah, he was my friend, but we didn't really know each other. I'm like, yeah, pretty much sums up how we feel about him too. We know he's a main character, but we know there's some importance to him, but we really don't know him. And he really didn't get to interact with any of these other characters as much as he could have.
Yeah, and let's talk about this with the preface of spoiler.
Yeah.
Spoiler times 10, okay? The death of both of those characters is, like, and I am absolutely 100% kill off, like, lead characters. Kill them off early, kill them off at randomly, kill them off, you know, potentially at inopportune moments where you're like, oh, he should have never died that way, you know?
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones is, you know, sparked off a lot of that sort of thing, right? But
Yeah.
Or people reference it typically, like, oh, it's just like Game of Thrones, they're killing whoever they want.
Yeah. But,
okay. The episode 7 with Taylor Kirsch, like,
Kitch,
in
yeah.
this Kitch. Okay, sorry.
Continue.
With this tunnel, like, one of the more, I don't know, one of the better shootouts in the show, just with the tension of it. The
yes.
underground sequence where he's you know, running around in the dark, and he ends up using his friend from the military as a shield.
Yeah.
You know, from another guy shooting him, who ends up killing his friend, and, you know, ultimately it's like he probably would have had to kill him anyway. So
yeah.
there is actually, like, in that moment, it's like, okay, like, he seems like he's trying to do the right thing. It, you know, it backfires-ish. I don't know. Like, he was going to probably end up having to kill all of them. Anyway, there's, like, a small moment of, like, oh, this is how this could have worked. And then he comes up from underground, and standing behind one door... okay, here's the thing. He comes down... no, this is real. He comes down way, right?
Uh-huh.
And then he's in this massive underground complex that could open up any number of places, right? And this is the thing that's like, I know that was suspend disbelief, but he comes up, there's no one following him, his phone doesn't have a signal, and there's a cop, a dirty cop, standing behind a door waiting to kill him, and he does. He just kills him. Like, he doesn't say anything, he blows him away. And then there's this small moment where Taylor's, like, crawling on the ground. He's like, no, you're not going to get me. And then he blows his head off, right? It's like, we're HBO. We can leave people in puddles of blood.
Yeah.
So that's how he goes. It's like, okay, fine. You know, that's how you want to do it. That's
Which,
fine.
You're... in my opinion, was the better of the deaths that happened in the last two episodes.
Right. And that's what I'm getting to is like, okay, so that's how you're going to take him out. But you're going to take Colin Farrell out. He's going to sit at a tree, all of a sudden look up into the sky, and have this strange, semi-religious, I don't know, like epiphany type thing, where the camera reverses back down on him, and it's almost like this, it is almost this, like, religious moment, or drug moment, right? Where he's like, it's similar to Rachel McAdams when she's in the party or whatever.
Yeah.
The camera shifts in really weird ways, and then the dirty cop that killed Taylor is standing there, and he's like, where's Rachel McAdams? You know, where's she at? And he's like, a better place. And then steps out from the tree, shoots zero bullets, and is riddled with bullets, and makes no effort to fight back. And then, Brandon, this is how we should probably end the episode. Unless you have other things to say. The whole tension of his moment is that he wasn't able to send a voice recording from his phone with a fake UI, by the way. That's not what it looks like when you send a voice message. Like, that doesn't happen. And that's a small tech nerd thing, but there is not a, like, sending voice message dialogue sequence like that. It's just not the way... He doesn't get to send the message to his son, who we find out is literally his son, but we've never seen the boy, like, his son, listen to these recordings. Like, that's what's so surprising to me is, like, we see him recording them. We never hear his son respond, and I get that. It's the son, you know, it's a one-way street. But, like, he doesn't even listen to them. We never have a sequence where he's, like, crying in his room or
yeah.
I don't know, like, if you're gonna spend so much time on it, like, give me something else. I don't know, it's personally
me, I would have, I know this is like, this is too, like, it might be too, like, positive, but I would have had the message go through, and then instead of the this is me spitballing, instead of that, what I would end up having was have it go through and end with the son listening to that message, and that'd be the last thing you see of his dad. Or if you wanted to get really kind of interesting, it might be completely wrong, I'm just tossing out an idea, like, we're in a writer's room, have the message go through, he listens to it, she gets the paternity test that he's not the father.
Well, no, he is the father.
I'm saying if you did it differently, okay, to where he has the effect that he always thinks that is his father, when in reality, you still have your positive and also negative moment of he gets the voicemail, he's sad that his father's dead, but then you find out he's not the father. Again, this is me just spitballing something that...
No, and I agree with you, and I think it's so interesting because of the way that they cross-cut. To me, it was, you know, again, disappointing with this, the way they killed off Taylor's character with just getting just blasted, you know, pretty much at random. After having, like, an anticipation of him dying in the tunnel before. But they're cross-cutting it with his wife, his girlfriend, pregnant, sitting in the room with his mother, watching, you know, a movie, watching... Yeah. Right, and watching a movie that's like, you know, bringing up all these, you know, overtones of you know, raising a child, and she's, you know, she's sitting there crying, and by the way, like, we don't really come back to her, right?
No, we get her one time, at the end when they're naming a highway after him,
right? With no dialogue, and like, I don't know, like, you know. I know there's not really any scenes with her or the mother alone as far as like a point of view of the camera.
No.
But I don't know, like, you know, she doesn't react to finding him, or you know, I don't, like, they're trying to have this poignant thing of him laying there blasted away on the street and her crying in the room watching this old film that's bringing up all these emotions. Yeah. And then the thing that just destroys it at every level is that the third cross-cut element is Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams grinding on each other in the room. And Brandon, this is just vulgar, and they did it in such a way that I'm like, how is this real?
No, here's, and also I'm going to it because we need to end it soon. I was going off of the finale. Early on, I was like, okay, we're doing something different, because I like the way they cut the opening scene of the finale with McAdams and Farrell going back and forth of like a conversation, but going to previous stuff, which I liked.
One of the high points of the, yeah, definitely.
I was like, okay, you're showing me something. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah. And my big thing, cause we talked about it last time, and I think it's slowly being talked about. I think it was funny that you were the first one to actually bring this up, was about how it really wasn't representing female characters that well this season. But because I remember when we posted that last one talking about that, no one really covered that until more episodes in. But you kind of pegged it fairly early on.
Well, I mean, it wasn't an original thought. I saw some criticism early of critics who were able to watch the first three episodes, and they were like, "Is this serious?"
Yeah, and see, I didn't find any, and then all of a sudden, it just kind of like by episode six, we start getting there. My big thing was that we pretty much. I'm okay that all the females essentially lived. Again, spoilers, all the females pretty much live, all the males pretty much die. That's what happens. So I can get this point across, is that the females live, but it's because the males are the ones that sit them out and say, you know what, you don't have to deal with this. Like, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to save you. And right, again, the biggest thing, I can get it more with Vince Vaughn and his wife. I can get that more. Yeah. I can't get it with Rachel McAdams, because she's literally the main character. I mean, she's supposed to be the main character of the series. She should be the one who is involved in this final type thing. Because I know they're like saying, well, she's the one who hands in the papers to get... But that's like, she's the messenger.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
You're nailing it, and it's such an unsatisfying thing, because here's the thing that I think you're supposed to gain by having a lot of different characters.
Yeah.
You get to see a lot of possible ways of dealing with similar situations. Right?
Yes.
In that Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell are both, at the end, confronted with how to handle, like, love. Basically, like, they both love a woman.
Yeah.
And they're trying to both get them out of the country from a bad situation. And they both go into the firefight together to steal money to do this.
Yes.
And they both go about it in pretty much the same way. And it's...
Yeah.
I mean, we could be done. But but Vince Vaughn rolling around in the car after having $4 million in diamonds in his pocket, and all of a sudden getting, like, cornered by two cars kind of at a stoplight, just like, I just don't get it, like,
which,
he's,
you know,
smart.
If he's smarter than that, he wouldn't, like, I'm thinking when I'm watching, like, he's about to get, like, he's screwed. It's like this.
Well,
this...
and I think that goes back to just, I'm so curious to see what if anyone ends up leaking the scripts to see what's on the page, because not that I'm encouraging that behavior, but it's like it feels tonally like in the first season, what may have just been white space on the page was made complete by a little bit of like foreshadowing visually, right? These undercurrents of things that are like, okay, get ready, we're gonna do this. Like, there's nothing. I mean, we know that Vince Vaughn is like, you know, being hunted probably, right? Yeah. But to be hunted by those Mexican guys and ultimately why? Because the clubs burned down, like that they were gonna have a chance to sell their product in. And so he kind of owes them, I guess. And then they get $1 million. And then the guy wants to take a suit. And, you know,
then we spend too much time watching him walk in the desert. And then he finally...
Well, and that's your surreal thing that you're, like, you know, supporting of, like, they're trying to do this. And
they're trying to do this, but it's not done well, I don't think, because it's just, like...
No, it's his father, and then it's these random kids. At that
point, to me, it's, like, at a certain point... that you have him walking, I was like, you might as well just keep him alive.
I'm like, well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's like, they're going to kill him, but it would be so much more interesting if he lives.
Yeah.
Purely to see, like, how does he live, number one. Yeah. But also, like, this,
it keeps, he's this tough character that, like, does all this stuff, and then he's able to, like, basically walk through the desert with a stab wound and, like, it's just he like basically all those. It would make more sense too to me with those things of his past. Like, I'm like, you're weak, this and that. And he's just like, screw you. Like, I'm tough. It'd make more sense if he just kept going, and like,
That's like the subvert. Like, I think the whole point of the season, in a way, like the sales pitch maybe is like, okay, you got the anti-hero. You've got this whole thing of I'm gonna subvert the audience's expectations. And I guess if there is a contrast between Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell, it's that Colin Farrell basically just gives up. He's like, I'm not a good man, and I'm better off dead. And Vince Vaughn is like, no, I don't give up. You know, like all of his storyline that we care about is like, you know, his dad leaving him in that basement, right? Yeah. That's like this trying to be this like poignant thing. And then we have a couple references to it throughout the season in nice kind of nice ways. And then... he's standing there and it's like, no, you gave up, you know, 25 feet back there. That was you. And then just falls over. And then that's it. And it's like, okay, the futility of, I don't even know. Like, if he is saying something, I just don't care what that something is. You know what I mean? Like, I disagree. And I'm also like, so unimpressed by it in a way that's like, I don't know. I know
it's just, to me, there was potential, because there was good stuff to me. I won't completely bash this season. There were good things, but it was missed opportunities.
Yeah, and a lot of great actors with great potential moments. And I think Vince Vaughn is one of those people who, if he didn't have the same "I'm a gangster, I'm gonna try and shake you down for money" scene just over and over and negotiating like business deals, basically, you know, of like, I'll give you 30% of this and 10% of that. And
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he just had so many redundant moments that never elevated it. Never elevated it in any way.
I stand by the whole fact that his best scene was that scene with the, when he threatens the guy, like, who's gotten beat up by his men. He's just like, he's that talking Vince Vaughn character. But besides, the thing is that's scary to me. Picture Vince Vaughn, the talking, fast talking Vince Vaughn that he is, but take away that comedic tone to it, and you add a violent streak to it, and you get something completely different. And it was a miss. It's too much like sitting down with the game, like with the if you hear fireworks going off, I'm by Disney World, so Disneyland, that's what's going on, because I'm hearing them constantly. Anyway, he is a character that is like he just sits down, like I said, he sits down and talks to people. It's like, and talks with the Russians and talking about this transportation deal, which, by the way, is just too complex for anyone to understand or to care what is going on.
You know, I don't know that it's like a lack of like audience ability to understand. You know, it's to me the thing. Just to wrap it up, because
yeah,
we gotta stop from just ranting forever. But to me, so much of it is a lot of the same beats are in the music, but the rhythm is all wrong. You know, and you have more instruments, right? You have more characters, and it doesn't turn into a melody. It doesn't turn into anything that resonates. It feels much more just, you know, broken and stilted in a way that's like, oh man, like, cause there is just like, there's a minimalism to the first season in a way where you're like, damn, I didn't know we could watch Matthew McConaughey smoke cigarettes and drink beer in a little conference room getting interviewed.
And it'd be so interesting.
Right. Hit me with it for 5 episodes. I'll watch every single bit of it, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's what's so interesting is playing that one instrument you have and just letting it sing at its absolute best. You're like, I didn't even know this was possible to get that out of a Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
That's a good Matthew McConaughey. And this is like, we got a whole bunch of instruments. We're just going to start lighting them on fire and blowing stuff up. And it just doesn't turn into music.
Was the thing too, with the season one, and we'll end up with this, is that McConaughey plays two different versions of Russ.
Yeah.
He plays this younger 90s version and even into the 2000s, but then when he comes back with the long haired and like the biker mustache and whatever, it's two completely different guys that make up the one person. It's like he's very different. He's become like he's darker than what he was before, and he was pretty dark and to begin with, but it's more just like him against the world. And then with season two, it made me miss like a Woody Harrelson character because McConaughey was that like dark philosophical, like could go into this monologue and then you could end with Woody Harrelson going, I don't know what you're talking about right now. Please stop talking.
Right.
And you get that good foil. But in the end, that's what kind of more of a cop thing is. You got to see them interact and you got two different people who in the end had some of the same views and they connected together. And we missed that in season two. It was like, it was just, we didn't get those moments. There were moments in the car of people talking, but it was never as effective as what it was before because there was never they never got into a routine. It was like, well, this episode, it's these people talking together. This episode, it's those people talking together. So it just, a lot of stuff was just inconsistent and they never really were able to get the ball rolling completely. So, on that note, we will stop talking about this because we'll probably go after we stop recording talking about this. Thank you guys for tuning in. Special thanks to William Mason, who does our music, to Dusty Fields, who did our music, and William Mason, who did our logo. Who else should we be thanking? Hunter Barcroft, who helped us with organizing some of our stuff. And also just all the people who listen every episode. We are incredibly ecstatic that we get the number of downloads that we get. And send us any feedback through iTunes or through our Twitter page or Facebook page. Our Twitter page is @CineNationShow and Facebook is just CineNation Podcast. And Ben, you can drop your Twitter handle.
Yeah, Twitter, you can find me at Sweet22, SUITE,
and
dose,
you can,
dose.
And you can find me at BCS _ the film kid. That's all for this episode. Thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you tune in for later episodes. Thanks. Bye.